Welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and welcome to part one of a two-part show featuring 86-year-old Max Borchardt. This week, Max takes us through his early years, where he grew up during the Depression. Eventually, he attended Melbourne Tech, now known as RMIT, where he achieved an excellent all-round education. His first job was in a brass foundry, which he describes in less than glowing terms, and he left not long after starting. At the declaration of the Second World War, Max volunteered for the Air Force. Wanting to be in a flight crew, he had to accept a position as an engine fitter. Eventually, he joined a Catalina crew as a flight engineer with 20 Squadron, but his first operational flight was less than successful when the plane got lost. But to tell the story and how it got to this point, here's Max. So Max, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me into your home, and could we start by asking you when you were born and where you were born?
You can. I was born on the 8th of the 11th, 1919, and I was born in Hawthorne.
What are your earliest memories?
Well, my earliest memories may be a bit vague, but I think I can remember things when I was about two. I remember my parents, and there was a property that belonged to my grandfather at Beaconsfield, 100 acres, pretty rural. But I remember being there, and I remember there was some people over the road, and they had this big dog, and I haven't got the picture now, but I was sitting there, I was apparently frightened of dogs, under a haystack, and this big collie dog beside me, which wouldn't have hurt a fly, that dog. But I do remember that, yes.
Right. Mm. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I had two sisters and one brother. I am the eldest. They're all dead. I had one sister 3 years younger than me, another sister 6 years younger than me, and my brother was 11 years younger than me.
There are big differences in the ages.
Well, sometimes people did have a child later in life. Mm. I assume my mother might have been getting towards 40 or something like that. I feel made a big impression on her life. I feel she probably was never the same afterwards. And it made a big impression on my life because at the age of 11, she more or less had to stay in bed, and she more or less taught me to cook, can I put it that way.
What was your father employed as?
My father... My name, Max Borchardt, I'm the third Max Borchardt. They were cap manufacturers, but not caps as you see them today. They had a small factory in the city, which had belonged to my grandfather, who was a German migrant. And they made, as well as making caps for men to wear cloth caps, they made the tramway caps, you know, the peak cap.
Right.
The railway caps. Also, the inspectors with all... And that was genuine gold braid.
What are your memories of Dad?
My memories of Dad? Well, I'm terribly sorry to say, my father and I were never that close. Now, he worked a lot.
Right.
The factory didn't make a lot of money, but it meant they had to do a lot of the work themselves. They employed a number of people, young ladies who they called their girls, but some of them obviously, and they stitched the caps together on sewing machines, you know, electric sewing machines, yes.
So, but when you think about it, if you were born in 1919, and that means you were born coming into the Depression era, so this dad was trying to operate during a depression, wasn't he?
We had a better life than a lot of people, but those years, they formed my life, and they formed so many young people like me, because people couldn't afford any sort of an education. Well, there's nothing wrong with a state school education, but you couldn't go on beyond a certain age. I mean, some boys left school at 12, and that was that. And they left school at 12, and there were no jobs anyway. Mm.
What are your memories of school? Did you enjoy it?
I always liked school. That may sound funny, but a lot of people don't. But I was a pretty shy boy, and I believe I had an inferiority complex as I grew up. But I liked school because I wasn't clever, but I was reasonable at schoolwork. I have never failed an examination of any sort in my life, and I feel that's why I enjoyed school.
Did you have a favourite subject?
My favourite subject was probably science. The best marks I got were in geometry. I wasn't terribly good at arithmetic, but I passed every subject, put it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, because your brothers and sisters were significantly younger than you, did that mean you relied on people like kids outside the family for your friends?
Yes, mainly. Though my people, I think their life, or my father's particularly, have been shaped by World War One.
Right.
Now, being German migrants, and my grandfather was interned for a short while.
In Australia?
Yes.
Okay.
But, as I mentioned, they made tramway and railway caps, and he was friends with the head of those things, the railways, and I think they got him out of internment because he certainly wasn't a threat. He was, if anything, a Lutheran. And they were deprived of the vote. Well, as soon as the war finished, and there must have been an election, the next time my father and my uncles, they were called up by the authorities because they hadn't voted, and I think they were fine. And this coloured my father's life for the rest of his life. Similar things are happening today, I believe. You know, it is, what do you call it?
Oh, the boat people and the people being interned in camps.
That's right.
Yes.
Though my people certainly paid their own way to come here, and they had...
But treated badly.
Yes. Well, particularly that one. My mother's father was also German, but he was a clockmaker. Not repairer, he made clocks.
Made them.
Mm. Yes. I must admit, I think my father's father was alive when I was about two. I never saw my other grandfather.
Right.
I just remember my father's mother and the other granny, as we call her. She was Welsh, a German grandfather and a Welsh grandmother. And she was around, she died when I was about 11 or 10 or something like that. And she was a nice old lady, yeah.
As a kid, what did you used to do outside of school, Wales?
Well, there was a number of kids around our way, and our pleasures were very simple. We just played outside. The girls had skipping ropes and played, I think they called us hopscotch, and I don't know what the boys did. We wrestled each other and all this sort of thing, but we really had no toys like they have today.
Mm.
But we're all happy. And there might have been, in my street in Hawthorne, might have been half a dozen kids. Now, we had a big block which had belonged to my grandfather, and kids, they used to come and play in our backyard, as we called it, but it was really four blocks, building blocks, put together. But it was pretty rough. It was just grass, and it was just a few trees and all this sort of stuff.
It sounds like your imagination played a very important part of your childhood.
I have been told I have a fantastic imagination. And oh, that was the other thing. I wasn't bad at school. I used to write essays, and apparently they got out of hand. I was told I shouldn't use my imagination so much. I cannot tell you what those essays were today, but English was one of my better subjects.
But to be told that is, in later life, you look back, must wonder, what were they on about?
Oh, absolutely. When I look at what people learn and do today, it was completely different.
Yes.
That you were given no encouragement, and if you showed any initiative, it was more or less quashed. That was as simple. That's in the States, Gil. In spite of that, the education was very good because you were regulated in class, you were not allowed to speak.
The discipline.
Discipline. Mm. And, of course, if you stepped out of hand, you got hit with a leather strap on the hand. And it was pretty severe, yeah.
Now, today the teachers aren't allowed to use it. In fact, even parents aren't supposed to be able to do that. Do you think that that's playing a part today in what we generally see happening to our community with violence and vandalism? Do you think that goes back to the school and discipline?
I do think that. I think there's a complete lack of discipline. I'm not going to say I enjoyed it, but I learned from it. And the kids today, all right, I do understand them, and they have a free hand. I'm not sure that it is leading in completely the right direction. I have some contact with, you know, young people, even school children, and I wouldn't say everybody's bad, even grown-ups, they're not bad either.
Listen to older voices, the magic of memories.
Well, moving it along a little bit, what age did you leave school?
I was a bit lucky. I left school at about 14. When I say I didn't have much education, I went to what was called a central school, which was a bit higher than, you know, the primary. And people went on to a high school from there. It was considered I wasn't suitable for a high school. I went to a technical school. I went to what was the Melbourne Tech, which is now the RMIT. It was called the Working Men's College in those days, junior school, and I was lucky because once I got there, I was interested in what I learnt. We did, you know, trade work. We did chemistry, we did physics a certain amount. We did wood turning, metal turning, sheet metal work, blacksmithing, and I can still do that today. The education, I consider, was so good that you could go out and...
It sounded like you had a good broad education.
Oh, yes.
Rather than just, you know, focusing in on one thing.
Absolutely.
What was your first job?
Well, after I left that school, there weren't jobs around.
Okay.
And I think it was the school sent me to a firm in South Melbourne, John Danks. And I was going to perhaps be a turner and fitter or a brass finisher. The conditions there were so primitive. The toilets were like dungeons. It was a brass foundry. The whole place was, you know, full of brass fumes. Mm. And it was pretty terrible. Anyway, my people thought maybe I shouldn't stay there. And I had an uncle up the country who was in a pretty big way, and he had a contact with a firm called AG Healing. Now, they weren't tradespeople, but they had departments that dealt, say, with cars, motorcycles, bicycles, plating. They made bicycles upstairs. They made radios upstairs, refrigerators. You got...
I remember the Healing now you've said, yeah. That. Yes, that's right. Radio and fridges were very big.
That's right. Well, you didn't get much pay. And what they used to do, after you got, say, you'd been there 3 years or what, and your pay had to double, they just said, you're sacked. It was as simple as that. I think the same thing's happening today. Well, I'm then going to about, what, 1938 or something of that nature, and I went, my uncle was one of their biggest customers. He went in and he went crook because it was him that told me to go there. I still had a week to go, and the managing director called me up and he said he'd made a mistake. Well, I knew what would happen if I stayed. I said, look, I'm not staying. So I went to work up in a small town near Swan Hill for my uncle. And I did work in the garage there. And I also, I had a cousin who was older than me, but was very clever. He could do anything. Well, he did refrigeration repairs, he did radio repairs, and the war was coming, and he was had done a flying course, and he wanted me to take over his job of doing all these things, which I could have. Anyway, that was the story of that. So I had just 1 year there, and of course the war broke out, and I, for some reason, decided to join the Air Force.
So you enlisted rather than waited to be called up?
Oh, yes. Well, the three services, the Navy's the top, the Army and the Air Force, you can only volunteer for them. There was another service which was described by a rather nasty name, Chocos, because they were called up.
Yes.
And, of course, eventually a lot of them went to New Guinea and places like that. But the three main services were all volunteers.
Right.
Yes, you had to volunteer.
So let me take you back to those very early days when you first enlisted. What was it like for you? Was it an adventure? Can you recall how you felt?
I can recall fairly well. I tried to get into the Air Force, and it was considered to be a bit of an elitist thing. And a mate and I went in, and we wanted to enlist an air crew. And they asked what educational standard we'd reached, and we said not very high. Well, my mate Jimmy, he'd only gone to the sixth grade in school, and so we just went away. And then they brought out a program, because the war in Europe escalated, where people went to school, brought up to a certain standard, and then could get into air crew. Okay, I decided I'd go into ground staff as a fitter, which eventually I got in as.
So you went and did this sort of this training school first?
I didn't, he
you
did.
You didn't?
I didn't. I asked what else I could go in as, and being interested in things mechanical, I could have been an engine fitter, an airframe fitter, or things like that. And I was put on there. Reserve and eventually called up and sent to a trade school. After we'd done the initial training, you know, which was drill and all that sort of stuff.
Did you enjoy that, or was that a tedium?
No, because I was always reasonably fit. I was always a small fellow. I only weighed 9'7", I think, but I had been a professional bike rider, so that was my sport, and I was always fit. And the drill course and all that sort of thing was no hassle at all. Yeah.
So that was, you enjoyed it and it was easy?
Easy, yeah.
Okay, so you finished that initial basic training.
Yes.
Then you went to the trade school, did you?
In Altamura in New South Wales.
And how long did that take?
3 months.
And was that intensive?
Yes, it was intensive. We did mainly bench work, bench fitting. Then we came back and we went to the showgrounds and we did what was an aircraft engine course there. And then we were passed out as fitters, or aircraft mechanics or fitters, yeah.
Right. And then what happened to you?
Well, I went down to which was the main base, Laverton, and I was there for a while. You really wouldn't have thought there was a war on, because each morning you had to get dressed in your uniform and go on to the parade ground, and the commanding officer conducted the parade. This is after breakfast. You went back to your barracks, changed into your overalls, then marched up to the workshops. And lunchtime, you marched back to where you got your lunch. And nighttime, you marched back and forth and so on. So strange, yeah. There was a war going on. Now, we were the lowest of lowest, but in our mess for the first while, they had tablecloths on the table, and you just all sat there. And I, being a bit backward in social things. The meals were put on the table and there was bread and there was butter. And if you weren't quick, the butter and the bread was gone. So you learned quickly. Yeah.
Well, yeah, survival instincts grow, don't they, if you're going to miss out?
Well, after a while, the Empire Air Training Scheme started up to train aircrew, and I was sent to Benalla, which was a pilot training school, as a fitter. And from there, that's where I was sent back to Melbourne to do an aircrew examination. I didn't go through the normal aircrew thing, and sent up to Rathmines on Lake Macquarie to do a flight engineer's course.
Did you ask to do that, or you asked?
In my particular case, I didn't ask. It was considered a privilege, and a lot of people didn't understand why I was sent.
Mm.
And I didn't understand either. I assumed it was because I'd got fairly good marks in the engine fitters course, yes. I wasn't anything exceptional, except they were looking for people maybe with a bit of knowledge.
Mm. So you went up to learn how to be part of a flight crew?
Yes.
And where was that again?
Rathmines on Lake Macquarie. Oh. And we did our training there, and we formed up a crew, and which was about 10 men, say two pilots, a navigator, two wireless operators, two engineers, and an airframe fitter who was a gunner, and an armourer who was a gunner. That was a complete Catalina crew.
And once again, your role was?
Flight engineer.
Flight engineer.
Yeah.
Now, what did the training consist of?
Well, to me, it was very difficult because I'd worked on a Togamoth engine, is similar to a car engine.
Mm.
A Catalina engine is a radial engine, 14 cylinders, and it has a variable pitch propeller and all sorts of things that took a...
Make it more complicated.
Oh, very hard to understand. But you passed out after 3 months. You did an air gunner's course as well, and then you were sent up to Cairns or places like that to join a squadron.
And which squadron did you join?
I joined 20 Squadron. There was 11 Squadron, and there was 20 Squadron. I was part of 20 Squadron.
And what was 20 Squadron's role?
Well, our role, my first flight from there as a operational flight was to bomb a town up in what was then Dutch New Guinea. It's now Irian Jaya, way up the top of there. We were sent there as a Royal crew, and we had to drop bombs on this town. And the navigator was new, and our first flight we got lost. So what it simply meant, you only flew when there was no moon, they couldn't see, and it was cloudy. So we climbed to 15,000 feet because the mountains up there around that, and we circled till daylight, and then, of course, he was able to, and we flew down to Thursday Island, had breakfast, and flew back to Cairns. Never got lost again. But that was our first
flight. Your very first flight. Yeah. So you didn't get to drop your bombs.
Oh, we dropped them on the target. It was our
getting back.
Back, yeah.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
And this is in the Catalina.
In the Catalina.
Okay, now look, I mean, I show my ignorance. I didn't realise flying boats carried bombs.
Well, early days they didn't. They were based on Rabaul, and they did, I suppose, they carried supplies and different things. They called it the milk run. But once the Japanese came into the war, the Catalina became a sort of dual-purpose machine and did things that should never have been asked to do. And, well, we just had to do it.
Okay. I mean, you said it was asked to do things which probably mean it wasn't built to do.
Yes.
Okay. Dropping bombs was one. What were the other tasks?
Well, we mined different ports. I flew on some very long distance flights, over 20 hours. That was, say, 11 or more hours out, and say, 9 hours back or 10 hours back.
That's not a long time.
Yeah. And we carried mines, say, like two, the size of them would be like putting more than two 44-gallon drums together, one slung under each wing. And we came in over a town. I know the longest flight, I think, was to, from Darwin to Surabaya in Indonesia, which it is now, which was Dutch, what was it then?
Was it West Indies?
Yeah, that was it.
Join me next week for part two of Max's story, which includes more about his Catalina experiences, like his 20-plus hour flights, and sometimes having to fly as low as 90 feet above the waves with mines hanging underneath the plane. We also learn how Max became involved in flying Beaufort bombers, and hear some hair-raising stories, such as the time the brakes caught fire, and the time some birds flew through the windscreen. And find out just what caused the pilot to chew off the ends of his moustache with anxiety. All this and more with Max Borchardt on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Turak Times.